We are back in advance of week three. Welcome inside. Eben is here. He's lurking quietly over in the corner until he's allowed to speak. Imaginary producer Steve is here. Keep up the great work, Stevie. Solid guy. We had several old friends join us in the week two tournament. Shout out to winner Tyler Brown, who continues his assault from downtown. He took home the cash. We have new friends in the college football landscape, too. We'll talk about them. We had our first mass text to send out the leaderboard and picks to everyone. That was exciting. Shout out Simply Texting, only slightly less complicated than figuring out which streaming services you have to piece together to be able to watch every game this season. What did we learn? We learned Michigan's defense is not as good as we thought it was. And even if it was, it has no offensive identity at all. Looks like Jimbo in Ann Arbor. Texas looks great. We learned that Oregon is not as good as preseason expectations. And that's okay. They're pretty good, but not great right now. I also think both Boise and Idaho are more credible than people give them credit for. But, I mean, Oregon has problems. Their D-line got moved around. It wasn't just Janty. That is not going to play in the playoff. We learned the cream of the Big 12 has the capacity to be as uninspiring as the middle of the Big 12. Cam Rising hurt again. Oklahoma State, no offensive touchdowns for the first, I don't even know how many minutes, but many minutes. Kansas State needing to go deep into the bag to beat Tulane. Tulane's a good team, but still, Kansas State's, what, top two Big 12 team? We're not supposed to care about the MAC until Tuesday nights in November, but we had the rise of the MAC a bit this week. Notre Dame is having 2022 all over again. Kept it really tight against a big-time ranked opponent in a low-scoring game on the road in their first game of the year. In this case, they won. They've garnered talk of a playoff appearance, going undefeated, and then they go lose to NIU. Just like in 2022, they turned around from Ohio State and they lost to Marshall. Bowling Green really surprised me against Penn State, who just came out and looked flat, to be honest. The Bowling Green offense looked really strong, but like the whole thing with Penn State is that its defense is legendary. Yes, they have Allen and Singleton, they have Aller, but it's their defense that was the best in the country last year. Not Iowa, not Michigan. Penn State had the best defense in the country, and they gave up how many points? To Bowling Green. Bowling Green's offense was what kept them in that game. Buffalo did not look good. They had Missouri and got pantsed 38-0. So it was not all glory for the MAC. Mizzou has not allowed a point this year. It is one of many highly ranked teams that just hasn't been tested yet. There's a bunch, actually. Georgia, I don't know how they don't win the title. I'm saying that in week two. Ole Miss has not been tested at all. They're a machine. Ohio State, nothing early. We thought Tennessee might get tested against NC State, but that was foolish. Why do we keep ranking NC State year after year? They are just never a good team, ever. What do we learn in the week two tournament? Our boy Rapid and Goss took second. He did not defeat Tyler Brown, but he took second with a noteworthy furious, one might say, late night push. He earned on his last six picks and he missed the top spot just barely. But man, I mean, look at what he came in on here at the end. He whiffed throughout the middle of the day and was in like 23rd, 22nd or something. And by the evening slate, the third of the four windows, he rattles off plus points on Tennessee to win by 12 or more, plus points on Nebraska to win by 12 or more, Clemson by 13 or more, Boise State by fewer than 19. Great call. He's in a duck family, so that took some cajones. Wazoo to win by six or more, plus points again. And Mississippi State to win or lose by fewer than eight. They lost by seven. He soared all the way up, and he finished with 827 points, besting Josh Pearl by nine. He was 19 short of Brown, whose Mississippi State pick at the end of the night One, the difference between his points earned for Mississippi State and Goss's was 25 points. And he ended up winning the tournament by 19. So it all came down to that last game of the night, in which Arizona State, they looked great, then they didn't look great, and then they revived themselves. Great night for the Pac-12 against the SEC. Cal beating Auburn, Arizona State beating... Right. Before we get to Eben, he's now rocking in the corner. I think he's really eager because he wants to talk about his five-pack. We will reveal, as always, drumroll, Steve. Oh, Steven. We don't have catchy titles for the games because you don't care about them. So we'll just give you the straight facts. This slate, by the way, a lot of people think is weak. It is weak. All games are going to wrap up by around 10:30 Eastern, 10 Eastern. We're not doing the late night stuff this week. We're going to give people a little break in prime time. So this will wrap mercifully earlier than the 2 a.m. Eastern wrap that it did with Mississippi State and Arizona last week. And we'll see how people like that. Game one, Alabama, Wisconsin, noon Eastern on Fox. You never know with the Badgers anymore. Alabama really struggled against USF until they didn't. We've talked a lot about Alabama. We'll see. This will be a good test. I'm sure there'll be tons to say on the morning shows leading into that. I wonder what Saban will be doing. LSU at South Carolina, noon Eastern, ABC, also ESPN Plus. South Carolina beat Kentucky last week. Are they a sneaky good team? Is LSU's defense as good as it was against USC? Does South Carolina have any offensive explosiveness? They just completely manhandled Kentucky. So this will be an interesting test, more validation, I think, of the Gamecocks potentially than LSU. But LSU going on the road, they want to bounce back still after the major loss to USC. Memphis at Florida State, noon Eastern on ESPN. This is game number three. Florida State has to win this game. They have to. Memphis is 2-0. I think this will be more competitive than people think. Game number four, Boston College at Mizzou. You're already snoring. Mizzou is really good. We just talked about how they haven't allowed a point this year. Then again, they played nobody. Boston College, of course, having the win over Florida State. They look strong. This is at 12:45 p.m. Eastern on SEC Network. We only bring you the best here at Robin. We only feature the most compelling games, but I do legitimately think, as they have been for many years in the past, that Mizzou is underappreciated, underrated, underrecognized. This could be a decent early test for them. It's more of a test than their first two games. Watch for Luther Burton. 3:30 p.m. Eastern on Peacock, game number five. It is the Apple Cup. I'm just filled with disgust, so I won't even preview this game. At 3:30 p.m. Eastern, this window is real stacked for purposes of this game. The get-right game for Notre Dame, they're playing at Purdue. They're in West Lafayette, and it's on CBS. None of this makes any sense. How does Notre Dame keep doing this year after year? Is Purdue going to make this really ugly? Is Notre Dame going to get itself right? Why is it on CBS? I don't like any of this. 3:30 p.m. Eastern on ABC, Texas A&M at Florida. If you can watch this whole game without throwing something at your television or throwing up, I commend you. I will personally fund the wagers of anyone that goes to the window and takes the Florida Gators team points total under. I don't even know what it is, but just take it and I will match your wager. Also at 3:30 p.m. Eastern on Fox, the Civil War, Oregon at Oregon State. Still so angry that I could spit. So we won't preview that. 3:30 p.m. Eastern on ESPN2, Tulane at Oklahoma. Tulane nearly took down Kansas State last week. We just talked about that. Oklahoma was supposed to blitz Houston out of the building and barely won last week. Houston is arguably the Big 12's worst team, or was projected as such. They also lost to UNLV. I don't even remember what the final score was in week one, but it wasn't great. So I'm expecting a little bit of a correction here for both teams. I'm looking for Oklahoma to get it done. It'll be interesting, though, if they can. 6:30 p.m. Eastern on the CW. Again, we only bring you the best. Ole Miss at Wake Forest. This is sort of like Missouri at Boston College. Ole Miss hasn't been tested at all. Wake Forest at least represents a team with a pulse. We will see how Ole Miss handles some sort of talent. Obviously, they're going to be heavily favored. Game number 11, UCF at TCU. A good old-fashioned Big 12 showdown, 7:30 p.m. Eastern on Fox. Game number 12, Georgia at Kentucky. Number one team in the country going to a school that probably had a lot of overlook last week when they were playing South Carolina. 7:30 p.m. Eastern on ABC. I don't think anyone expects Kentucky to have a chance, which is kind of why we're featuring this game. So those are the 12 that are comprising week three. Again, card out 6 p.m. Eastern Wednesday, as it always is. When we return, Eben comes out of the corner and onto the program to discuss the House settlement, or should I say the lack thereof, and where that leaves things with the ever-evolving landscape of NIL. Brett Yormark's failed-ish basketball school-related expansion in the Big 12, and my contention for maybe what he's going for there. Washington State and Oregon State not coming to an agreement with the Mountain West for their schedule next year, what that means for who they're going to play and whether or not they're coming back out maybe on the open market. Is there any value there? And why do we have an NFL game on a Friday if we can muster ourselves to care briefly about the NFL? Back in a minute. This fall, Robin is partnering with several awesome partners to help put on our college football prediction tournaments, and we got to shout out a few of them right now. First, Club Sportico. They're obviously a presenting sponsor of the tournaments, and they are a newsletter and a community from the reporters at Sportico aimed at breaking down the billions of dollars flowing into and changing sports. They're offering tournament prizes and giveaways as well, and they're going to help the commissioner, that's me and friends, make sense of the dominant stories across the sports business landscape each week on this podcast. Check them out at clubsportico.substack.com. Teams That Matter is a Friday morning newsletter from longtime Robiners, Sam, the Ransom Note, Ransom, and Michael, the Pelequin Brief, Pelequin. It's offering their takes on all things college football and other titillating topics. TTM is going to help you get your head in the game as we move into each of these precious college football Saturdays, and they hope that they're going to do it with a little bit more nuance, a little bit more tact, a little bit more mindfulness than maybe the ESPNification of everything these days. Check them out at theteamsthatmatter.com. And last but not least, Volume Pigs. Hilarious name, but actually a seriously good site. He's an economist by day, but he's a college fantasy football writer by night. He's a first-year Robiner. His name is Justin VP Leo, and he started the newsletter just 1 year ago. It's already a bestseller over on Substack. I can attest there's something at Volume Pigs for any college football fan, even if you don't play fantasy, because I don't, and I read it and love it. Check it out over at volumepigs.com. We are back with Eben. He's released from his prison in the corner. He's allowed now to voice his full thoughts. He's been patient. He's served his time. We don't have a six pack today. We have a five pack, I think.
Getting closer to reality, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I could start with one before we go in. While I was in my time out, I did my homework listening to the pod last week with you and David Purdom. You used a word that I'd never heard before, antediluvian. I had to pause the podcast and look up what antediluvian, figure out how to spell it, first of all. So very nice. I'm going to be working that one into my repertoire moving forward, Will. Congratulations.
You know, Evan, this might get you back in timeout. If there's one thing that I like to do, it's make people really confused by using $15 words that they then have to stop whatever they're consuming to then try to figure out. That's my whole goal. It's certainly what I strive for
Success.
Here at Robbins.
Well, yeah. Let's do it again. Yeah, I've got my dictionary out if needed.
All right. Who knows? When we get to number three or four, we might uncork something. Number one, the House settlement. Hmm. this thing has woven through so many twists and turns. You're going to know what those are better than I. For the people at home, Judge Claudia Wilkin had to recently sign off on a settlement, which itself took a very long time to reach between the plaintiffs and the defendants in this case. She did not do that. She denied the settlement. How much does Wilkin's ruling or decision to not accept the settlement really blow things up from a timing perspective and from a complication perspective?
I think we're going to see this settlement from the NCAA side and from the plaintiffs in these three different antitrust suits was supposed to be the thing that created the framework for the future of college sports. The business structure, money that was going to be shared with athletes. It was kind of, it was messy from the beginning. There's a lot of people in the NCAA, particularly in smaller conferences, that do not like anything that is in the settlement, feel like their voices were not heard during the process. But there's bigger issues now. As you said, there was a hearing. Judge Claudia Wilkin, who is the judge that has presided over almost all of the big NCAA lawsuits over the past few decades, she is very, very knowledgeable about the NCAA, its business model, its form of amateurism, and those that are trying to get antitrust claims against it. And she sent them back to the drawing board, essentially said, the way this is laid out does not make total sense to me. I am not going to allow it until you answer some questions and also tighten up some language around NIL. And I think the thing to answer your question, Will, that set my antennas up is that the lawyer for the NCAA afterwards essentially said, we're not really going to budge anymore on this. More or less, he said, we've given everything we're going to give in terms of athlete compensation and restructuring. And if that is indeed true, if there's no more for the NCAA to give and the judge doesn't like what the NCAA has given, yeah, there's a chance that this thing falls apart entirely. That would be an absolute shock, but it seems possible.
And one of you speaking to that point, you know, one of McCann's suppositions, again, legal analyst for Sportico, Mike McCann. I actually worked with Mike in a former life.
I know, former colleague years. I was going to ask if you work together at all. He's prolific. It's incredible.
We've written together, actually, which was like the highlight of my career. I can't believe that I was even allowed to do that. like my name was on a byline, which is, you know. But one of McCann's contentions, though, to your point, is that they're not going to budge. They could take this, you know, all the way up the courts, right? Could this potentially go to the Supreme Court? Then you're looking at, you know, God knows how much longer. But I want to get back to Wilkin's opposition. You and I spoke on previous podcasts about just how contentious this was, right? It was insanely hard for folks to get just to this point, period, for there to be a settlement at all. And even with that, many of the smaller conferences felt like they were completely screwed. And I think that there is some justification in thinking that way. So just setting the table, right? It took all that even just to get here to begin with. And I want to read this passage from his piece because this just, maybe I'm too antediluvian.
But bingo.
Hello. From the piece. Wilkin urged the attorneys to revise language regarding restrictions on name, image, and likeness. She was especially troubled by the settlement's plan to launch an NCAA-backed entity that would, one, oversee NIL, two, supposedly distinguish real NIL, he puts that in quotes, deals from those that cloak pay-for-play arrangements, three, impose a so-called fair market value analysis, four, require athlete and school disclosures on NIL deals that exceed $600, shout out W2G, and establish a five, court-like dispute resolution framework. Wilkin worried this framework would chill the NIL marketplace and deprive athletes of opportunities, end quote. Am I truly correct in understanding that her concerns, after all of this, after we got to this point, is that there's not going to be enough NIL? Her concerns are that there could be a mechanism that actually does distinguish pay-for-play arrangements from, I guess, well-concealed pay-for-play arrangements. Like, these are the concerns we have?
Yes, I think you're correct about that. So much of the antitrust lawsuits that have come in front of the NCAA in the past decade have been about artificial caps on compensation. And you can make an argument that, and you and I talked about this a few weeks ago, Will, that this settlement is another artificial cap. some people have called it a salary cap, right? It's $20 million or so a year in revenue sharing for athletes, nothing more than that. And the way that you get around that being an absolute cap on what Will Green, the star quarterback at Washington State, can make is that you also have the ability to make NIL money. And she is worried that because of all of those restrictions that you listed off that the NCAA wants to put in place for the NIL portion, that yes, signing and putting this new future in place as it's written out in this settlement would essentially cap Will Green's NIL money moving forward because of all of the hurdles that have to go through now to make sure that your deal with your local coffee roastery isn't just because you're here to play with Wazoo and not because, you know, you're making sure it's not pay for play and making sure it's something else, right? Because you're showing up at the coffee house every Saturday morning to pour cappuccinos for people. That's her concern, is that she wants to make sure there is still an open market for athletes to make money based on their marketability. And that the way the NCAA settled this right now, that maybe that's not so true.
What does it say, though, that neither side, who could basically agree on nothing, neither side thinks that she has merit in those criticisms? And they told her that.
Yeah, they both want this to go through. If you're a lawyer for the plaintiffs here, you think you got a revolutionary deal that's going to make a lot of money for yourself, going to make a lot of money for former college athletes, and also fundamentally reshape the way that college athletes are compensated moving forward. If you're a lawyer for the NCAA, this is a palatable loss, is what it is. Let's be honest. This is not what the NCAA wanted to happen, but this is a format under which the NCAA believes it can continue to uphold all the things that it cares about. So yeah, I think it's fair to say both these groups want this to happen. They both want Claudia Wilken to sign this thing. And again, if she decides not to and they can't reach an agreement that makes her happy, yeah, there's a chance that we're going to see this thing, the NCAA, go back to court, let the House settlement, which is the first and most advanced of these three antitrust lawsuits, go in front of a jury. The loser of that will appeal it to the Ninth Circuit. The loser there might try to get the Supreme Court to pick it up. That could be 10 years, right? This could be heading down that road. And again, I don't think anybody in college sports wants that. And again, if the NCAA has to do that route, the preferred option is this settlement at this point. Rather than spending tens and tens of millions of dollars and spending 10 years trying to litigate what the NCAA is and what it's not.
I need you to make a prediction live on the air.
Oh, man.
What is going to take longer, a true final terminal resolution to the House settlement or the NCAA going away? Segue alert, topic number two. UConn is not joining the Big 12 after all. Color me completely shocked.
Not yet.
Yeah. And neither is Gonzaga. Not yet.
Yeah.
Here's how and why this is a segue. You can tell it's a good segue because I have to explain how and why it is one. UConn and Gonzaga are not joining the league yet. The Big 12 has been very entrepreneurial. They're sort of not large enough to pose a threat to the Big Ten and the SEC, but they are clearly above, I would say, the ACC in terms of their future viability and any other smaller conference. So they're in this weird sort of liminal space. The NCAA makes 90% of its money from the ultra lucrative NCAA men's basketball tournament. People are bashing your mark for taking a basketball school focused approach. Is your mark's move, in your opinion, predicated on the idea that the NCAA could go away, and that if the NCAA does go away, the tournament will need to pay the conferences for the rights at the next rights negotiation, and what conference is going to have all of the powerhouse basketball schools?
It's interesting. I had not honestly hadn't really thought about that. It's certainly possible. If the NCAA goes away, having a big basketball entity is going to be valuable for sure. And in that future, you could see a world where he tries to pick the ACC clean, maybe not of University of Miami and maybe not of Clemson, but of Duke and the schools that are more basketball focused. I think Brett's number one concern right now is to build the third best football conference. But
he's not going to do that. But he's not going to do that with a basketball focused expansion.
He's not. I think he is thinking about everything. It is one thing that I think Brett is very good at. He's well known for. I think it's what's made his hire really interesting. I think the media has to think about how they cover Brett a little bit differently, in my opinion, because you could write so many stories that are Big 12 considering this, renaming the conference to All-State 12. The Big 12 is considering moving its headquarters to Mexico. Like, I'm just making things up at this point. But UConn is going to be something he thinks about a lot, I think. UConn makes a little bit more sense than Gonzaga to me because there is a football element. It's a bad football element, albeit right now. But you could maybe see a world where UConn, as a school, turns that around in some capacity if it gets into a conference that has money flowing and really wants to make a move at it. But I think what Brett is doing on the basketball side makes sense. He's just looking for ways to stand out. And his schools have all missed the boat on A-plus top-tier or conference realignment. But they are, as you said, they're the number three or number four group right now at the very worst. And I think he would make an argument that they're the number three. And as a result, yeah, he's going to look at and try a bunch of different things. The argument that I don't like is people talking about how regionally the Big 12 needs an outpost in the Northeast. I just don't. That feels like kind of archaic TV model, Big 12 network style thinking that I think is kind of died in the last 10 years to a degree with the streaming future that we all have. But yeah, I could certainly see a world where he is thinking ahead at, if the NCAA disappears, there's a lot of money in the NCAA basketball tournament. It's not the money that's in the college football playoff. And he would obviously rather have the football money. But yeah, being a good basketball conference can be lucrative. It's maybe a stronger version of what Val Ackerman and the Big East are thinking, right? They're not even trying football, but they have a lot of the big basketball schools and they're making money on the basketball side.
Washington State and Oregon State, topic number three, have not come to an agreement, or they failed to come, past tense, to an agreement to continue on their friendly scheduling pack with the Mountain West. In basketball, they will be playing in the WCC, which still completely blows my mind. Where does this leave them for next year? I mean, I'm looking at these two team schedules this year. We've got Civil War and the Apple Cup coming up this week. Also completely bizarre.
Yeah.
They've patched things together, right, with random Mountain West teams as like a friendly gesture. Now they don't even have this next year. Does this signify to you that these two schools, who according to you, might have a little bit more value on the open market than I thought, as I assume here sitting in that region of the country, that they are somewhat largely discarded because of the monetary viability from tourism, from viewership, from the net worth of their alumni on average compared to other fan bases. Are those characterizations maybe wrong? And do you think that by going away from this Mountain West scheduling pack, maybe they think that they have a little bit more viability? They're out there to test the open market? Or did they just alienate like the one friend that they have, and next year is going to be Ball State and Liberty on the schedule all the way through?
I wish I knew where negotiations fell apart here. They're paying $14 million. The Pac-2 are for this 1 year for Mountain West games. It's six or seven games, I think, something like that. So let's just call it about $2 million a game or so. Multiplying that, it's $1 million a game for each school per game. So there's money to play with here for next year. I think I read that both these schools have six or seven games scheduled already for next year. So they need, again, roughly the same amount, again, double that. So five or six games each has $7 million to play with. Can you get five or six games with $7 million? You probably can. Are they grade A matchups? They're probably not. Is playing San Jose State a grade A matchup? Not really either. I don't know. I would be curious to hear if folks at Wazoo and at Oregon State thought that the more they play in a conference like the West Coast or Mountain West, the more they feel like they're a group of four schools. And if maybe their goal is to try to get Vanderbilt or try to get, pay $1 million to a school like that to try to get a better schedule. I actually don't know. And I wish I did, because I'd be fascinated to hear how folks at those two schools are thinking about things. But I don't think they have too much value right now. Mountain West feels so obvious for them for a number of reasons. I'll be fascinated to see what's the mood like where you are. Are there Wazoo fans that are? Is it existential crisis? Is it optimism? I mean, what's it look like?
I was not at the Texas Tech game on Saturday. I've talked to some folks that were at the game, and basically, you know, it was, well, this is just another day. You know, we're here at the game. The beat goes on, and obviously fans are upset, right? But, you know, they're still going to show up and they're going to support their team. I think it's hilarious, by the way, that the two quarterbacks last year, because I was at the Washington State Oregon State game last year. I had to go because it was like watching a mutual funeral take place. Cam Ward and DJU, right? Two of the most talked about quarterbacks in the country this year for completely opposite reasons. very opposite reasons. They both went both geographically and metaphorically as far away from the Inland Northwest as possible. And now they're being talked about. The Cam Ward thing particularly bugs me because, you know, people are like just discovering him this year. He's a Heisman front runner along with Ashton Giante, another Inland Northwest player. And this was on full display for like a long time, but I digress. I don't know why the negotiations broke down either. I would be, the thing I'm most curious to know about is what was bad about this arrangement for the Mountain West. And if it was the Mountain West that walked away, like you're getting paid to have schools that are probably a little bit better than your average school.
Yeah.
Come and play you all the time. And you're getting paid. I would love to know the thinking behind the Mountain West. If it was in fact the Mountain West, it was like, no, we're good.
I'll put on my tinfoil hat for one last second here. There was a part of this agreement, from what I understand, in that the money that the Pac-12 was going to pay the Mountain West would go up dramatically if they tried to poach Mountain West schools. So maybe there's a chance that they have decided that next year is going to be the time they are going to get aggressive about regrowing the Pac-12 under schools, including some schools that are in their geographic region that might be in the Mountain West and don't want to lock themselves into having a financial penalty to doing that.
So you think that maybe the Mountain West potentially feared that they were letting the burglars into their own home to live with them, and they might rob it from the inside and say, come on over, we own all the rights, we've got this whole construct already set up.
Yeah, or that the Pac-12 realized that extending this another year just made the financial burden harder if they wanted to suddenly pick six schools from the Mountain West and say, hey, we're the new Pac-8. Come right on and do this. That seems possible to me. And one other thing, I mean, listening to you talk about DJU and Cam Ward, I think one of the sad things about the future of college football, and at least in the near and medium term, is that any school that is not a big, big program, the minute you have a star, your fan base is just like, we got him for a year, right? Like, right. We're a Pac-2 school. We're a Mountain West school. Our quarterback is awesome. If he was on Miami, he'd be a Heisman Trophy candidate. Well, he's going to be on Miami next year. Right. Like it's that simple. I think that is a sad and that's a frustrating thing. It makes me glad I'm not a fan of anyone that's not in the SEC or Big Ten, because I think now anytime there's a star playing in some of these places, there's just going to be this huge, huge cloud of, this guy's not going to be here next year. This guy's going to be playing at Ohio State, or this guy's going to be playing at Georgia or at Alabama. And that, I think, is sad and frustrating.
Isn't it funny how that bothers us more than coaches that have a successful run at a tiny school getting poached by a larger school, which has happened forever, right? But when it's players, it's different, and it bothers us. And
it's a great point, and I think it does matter, right? Like, I think that is... I think for most football fans, if you had a star quarterback and you went to them and you were like, by the way, next year you're losing your coach or you're losing that quarterback.
I think
most people would say goodbye.
I think it also underscores that people watch these games, if anything, for the players more than the coaches.
Yep.
Which makes sense, right? That makes complete sense. We quasi disagreed when we talked about this Although you were flattering enough to not take a full-throated exhortation against my stance. But we somewhat disagreed that, because I proposed to you in a previous conversation that for fans who are extreme fans of a team, diehards, they've always followed college football, they have their team and they're in it, or fans who were total casuals, right? Maybe their husband is a fan, their wife is a fan, they walk through the living room and it's on for 3 minutes as they pass and that's their exposure, right? Those ends of the extreme would not be affected in any way by the changes, right? Underscoring college football.
Yeah.
And that the middle of the road fan, maybe a fan that just likes the sport. Those do exist, by the way. There are dozens of us, right? Fans that just like the sport. Fans that watch a couple of the good games each week, regardless of the team, right? It's just, you know, what are the best games on? What are the primetime matchups? Where's game day going? Where's big new kickoff going? Those fans would begin to kind of read between the lines. And they would probably have their sentiment affected, right, in terms of how they enjoy the game. And I've heard from a couple of folks that I would say fit that description, not because nobody listens to the podcast. They don't know that I said that, but they have basically said exactly that. I'm wondering if you have seen or observed any of that. If you think that that's off base still.
Yeah. I mean, I still think I disagree. I mean, I think it is all situation dependent in some ways, right? Like your diehard Oregon State fan, livid, right? Like, sucks. The change in college sports in the past 2 years has left your team behind. That's really bad. I think the diehard, I mean, I don't know many Oregon fans, and I'd be curious if they feel like they got off a sinking ship or if they're nostalgic about rivalries on the West Coast that they're not going to have anymore. I think it kind of depends on the situation. I'm the middle guy. I have no team that I root for. I pick a couple teams every year that I'm like, this team's cool. Like, let's get on Ole Miss and see what happens.
We are both that guy. That, I think that's what makes us interesting. I think we are both a minority species in this.
So I'll go first and I want to hear your experience. Also, I feel no negative. I don't feel any worse about college football now. In fact, I feel better that athletes are getting their bag in some ways, right? And the scenario I just gave about a mid-tier program who has a star quarterback and you just know the guy's going to leave, that sucks for your fan base. It's great for the player, right? The player's probably going to make a lot more money that he deserves because he's very talented. So I am – my enjoyment has not changed that much. It's going to take me, I don't memorize player movement in the off season. And I'm going to spend the first probably 10 weeks of the season being like, oh, that guy's here now. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I remember him from where he was last year, or two teams ago, whatever it is. But I don't care about the sport enough to feel like vertigo all of a sudden when DJU is playing in Tallahassee. And I'm like, wait a second, wasn't he just at Oregon? And then he was at Clemson before that. So I don't personally feel that way. I think there's probably some people in our world that do. I want to hear your thoughts also, because I think there's some fans, diehard fans and some casuals that are, depending on their situation, either loving what's happening or are livid about.
The player movement doesn't really bother me that much. That's kind of annoying, but like you said, like, I have no right to sit here and say, oh, well, how dare that player inconvenience me by leaving the place where I was accustomed to him being, like, whatever. I don't really care about that. How the displeasure has, I guess, manifested itself for me in watching, and now we are completely off the Evan six pack, by the way, the displeasure, great, how it's manifested itself for me, it's been more in this idea of the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And we have to still pretend that there's 134 teams competing for the same thing. I didn't like that before because it wasn't true before. And now it's just like in your face, not true. And it strains everyone's credulity and credibility. And that's exhausting to me. I like watching this where I had a Twitter account. You'll laugh at this. It was called 128 CFB Playoff, And the whole premise was that there needed to be a 128-team college football playoff because that would at least give at least lip service to the idea and mathematically give service to the idea that, because at the time, right, there weren't even 128. I think there were like 123 or something, but it was clearly progressing. And now we're at 134. It would give both mathematical and thematic lip service to the idea that, yes, we're all theoretically competing for this. It would also, it, like, in my mind, you would have had a 9-game conference schedule, and then everyone gets a berth into this tournament, and it's double elimination. And basically, you would only play your conference games, and it would get rid of, like, the need to schedule Bowling Green and almost lose, shout out Penn State, you know, 5 times or something, having all these bye games. I've always been, totally romanticized, or I have done my part to romanticize the whole 128 team. You know, we're all competing for the same thing, right? And we're just not. And now that has been turbocharged, I think. And everyone's pretending like we're still this thing, and we're not. I also am just...
You feel like there's gaslighting going on.
I feel like that is going on. And is that a thing that's going to jump out? Oh, it's 3rd and 7, Texas A&M going for the first down against Florida. Like, no, it doesn't enter my mind at that discrete moment in the game. But it just kind of covers everything like a patina. And the other one, which we won't belabor because we've talked about it a ton, that also just kind of covers everything like a patina, is... You know, we're doing the thing that Judge Wilkin is concerned that we might actually have checks and balances for as part of the settlement, which is just nakedly bribing players to come to places. And like before, I like to naively think, perhaps emphasis on naive, that if this is the year, you know, 1998, and, you know, you're not like the top recruit in your class, but, you know, maybe you're a low 5-star and you live down the street from, I don't know, not a Power 5 program, but you've always wanted to go there and you have relationships there and you're going to be recruited there. You might actually be convinced to go there. And, you know, your dad doesn't need to be Dion coaching at Jackson State to get you to go to Jackson State. You could actually, on your own volition, maybe, theoretically, it's unlikely, but you might want to go there. And now you have 0.00 chance of going there. And so I think the second thing that really kind of bothers me is that there's competitive balance amongst like 20 schools. And that's cool if you just want to watch a super conference. And like, I could even be into that. You want to make a super conference of 20 schools and everybody gets paid a ton of money and it's just like a bidding war. And then you have these other 100 schools and like they're competing for their championship. I'm not even mad about that. I would watch that, but we're not doing that. We're just doing this weird sort of thing in the middle. And, you know, we're saying that it's a descendant of let's pay the athlete who, you know, revenues were made off the backs of unfairly 6 years ago. Right. And really it's the brown paper bag. Those are the two things, and it's really hard to it's hard to quantify how those two things impact how I enjoy stuff, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Because
You know, all that made sense. I have two things to say that maybe is a little optimistic. One, you're right. The rich are going to get richer, and it's going to be harder and harder for anyone not in this elite two conference world to be a really great team in college football anytime after probably the next year or two. But I think there's going to be a lot more parity in those top two conferences. And if 5 years ago there were realistically 10 teams that could win a national championship, and really probably 5, I think there's a chance that in 5 years we could have 20. That there could be 20 Alabamas and Georgias as opposed to 5 Alabamas and Georgias. And that to me is interesting also. If every SEC game was theoretically 10% or 20% more competitive than it is right now, that to me is a different sort of parity that is actually kind of enticing. So I think there's a world in which that happens, in which the idea of Alabama and Georgia over under wins being 11.5 just totally disappears in 2 years. that the SEC is too strong, the Big Ten is too strong, that teams going undefeated just never happens again. And that I'm excited for that. I love that idea. I like the idea of every game being critical in the back half of the season.
But what you're talking about is the NFL.
Yeah. People love the NFL. Will
they do, but I think people think that college is different from the NFL, and I think they love college for reasons that are totally different than reasons they like the NFL. And that's my point.
Yes, and I think within that you can still have some of these things, right? The marching bands are still going to be playing. Some of the traditions are still going to be going on.
We'll still have the bands.
Don't laugh at that. That is, for me personally, like, one of the things I love about college football is that it sounds,
I love the band.
It sounds so different than NFL football. The second thing I'll say is that at least right now, Northern Illinois can still beat Notre Dame. And that's great, right? Like, that's awesome. I think you're going to, those are going to disappear. I agree with you. But at least in the current state of things, we're still getting bad MAC teams that can beat a top five FBS school. So at least for now, still have it.
We had the rise of the MAC this past week, by the way.
You're conveniently leaving off Kent State losing to St. Francis, Pennsylvania. Is that who that was?
There were some falls of the MAC as well. Yeah, St. Francis, PA. Who's their mascot?
The Pioneers? I don't know.
Yeah, they're Franciscans. Okay. Think St. John's.
They're the Red Wave.
What would happen if the Communist Party of China lit off a bunch of fireworks? There'd be a
red candles, red explosion, red bang,
red flash. we can't even do verbal charades.
I would have gotten there eventually.
Absolutely no one will have listened this far. So I'm just going to go.
But Bob in St. Francis, Pennsylvania is screaming at his steering wheel right now. It's red flash!
It's right. Come on! See, St. Francis, they could still get a berth into the NCAA tournament, the basketball tournament. They could still mathematically have a chance to win.
And take a look at them in the FCS playoffs come December.
Yeah, I not only did I leave off Kent State, I left off Buffalo getting shipped by Missouri, which I spoke about in the intro. Missouri has not given up a point this year. I am all in irrationally on Mizzou, and I am also all in irrationally on Oklahoma State, who barely survived at home against Arkansas. Okay.
I like that.
Hey, speaking of FCS teams, by the way, Oregon, who's got some splaining to do after barely, and I mean barely, I watched that whole game, I mean barely hanging on against the second straight team from Idaho. I wanted to write about this in the Friday roundup last week, and I just didn't have space or time. Their coaching staff had shirts made after the Idaho game, which, if you go way back in time, 2 weeks ago, was almost a loss by Oregon. They won 24-14. Yeah. They had shirts made that said Idaho 2.7 YPC, meaning that against Idaho's defense, the Vandals' vaunted defense, nothing the Vandals have ever done has been vaunted, they averaged 2.7 yards per carry. And no one, all six Idaho fans I think that exist, was like up in arms. There was no shit talking.
It's very bizarre.
There was no, and that is because if you are Idaho, and I want to introduce people maybe in your neck of the woods, right? In the media loudmouth capital of the world, the Miami, Floridas of the world, people that live in places where braggadocio is a currency, right? Where it's just a way of life, who can't even fathom what this is like. Come to Lewiston, Idaho, because if you're there, Oregon, when people say, with all due respect to you, there's no due respect here. This is the literal opposite of respect.
Usually that's what all due respect is. Like, yeah.
People are making shirts saying that they only beat you by 10 points, and only beating you by 10 points is so offensive, I have to use that piece of evidence to motivate my players. And you're like, yeah, I would be offended if I were you. That is really bad. That's how Idaho wears it. The Kibbe Dome is constructed of concrete and shame. And I just wish that people knew the differences in how some fan bases react. They're all out fly fishing anyway. And God bless them. I'm just saying, imagine being that fan base where like no one's even talking back because the seven fans are just like, yeah, we're kind of irrelevant. And then they go out, they knock off an FBS team last week. They beat Wyoming, right? Now Wyoming does suck, but they beat an FBS school. I'm just saying, maybe they're not actually that terrible. And they're a top, they are absolutely ranked in the FCS poll. They're top 10 in the FCS poll, I want to say. So
they are number seven now that they have it up. But look out for my boys, St. Francis. The Red Flash are going to be flying up, up these charts.
Right.
Look out. Wait, Kent State is the Golden Flash, correct?
That's a great point. The Golden Flash is.
So this was Red Flash versus Golden Flash?
How did we miss that?
Oh my gosh, how did this not get national attention?
You got to put it in prime time and there has to be fireworks. That's the only,
Golden Flash is versus the Red Flash. Oh my gosh.
Oh. Clearly, evidently, one single flash was more effective than a series of golden flashes.
One single red one, much better than a barrage of golden ones.
I wrote a game preview of Alabama-Tennessee, and in it, Nick Saban is tormenting Kalen DeBoer. He won't leave his side, right? He only goes to do game day, and then he actually secretly hangs around the Alabama sideline because he doesn't think DeBoer is tough enough. So he's trying to taunt him, right, in that healthy masculine way to, like, taunt him into being more of a man, right, because he's worried that Alabama is going to lose all its glory because he can't actually let go. And in so doing, he tells Kalen DeBoer a story of how Eastern Washington got its red turf field. And he says, well, I gave that idea to Jim McElwain when Jim McElwain was on my staff back when I was the coach at Toledo. In the Glass Bowl at Toledo, they had a themed promotion back when NIL was not legal, but they still needed to raise cash so they could pay people under the table to come to the great University of Toledo. They had a promotion for the boosters on the 4th of July, intermixed with spring practice, called Rockets Red Glare, named for the Toledo Rockets. And it was a fireworks show that went horribly wrong. And there were lots of red flashes. And of course, the field ended up being covered in blood because we had a lot of line drive fireworks. And then suddenly he says that bastard Jim McElwain stole the idea because two seasons later, Eastern Washington started having totally red turf. So thank you for letting me tell that vignette that didn't happen that I wrote about that nobody.
This is just a Mac podcast, really. Let's be honest. If you're a fan of Toledo or Kent State or Buffalo or Northern Illinois or whatever it is, this is the show.
For this you. Is absolutely it. And it's why we're going to end on the completely related topic of the NFL in Brazil. What is more interesting, that we had a NFL game occur on a Friday night or that we had an NFL game occur in Brazil?
Both, maybe, I think is the answer. We did a very fun, my colleague Jacob Feldman for Club Sportico, which I think Robin listeners are going to be hearing a bit more about, but it's a new Substack that we launched over at Sportico, a sports business community, kind of taking all of these topics we're talking about and trying to add a kind of a fun and approachable lens to it. Jacob wrote a thing about a law that I think most, even diehard football fans will in America would not know about, but it's the Sports Broadcasting Act of 1961. JFK signed it into law. And what it did was essentially...
It's one of my favorites.
It's a great law. Yeah, fantastic. People say it's the best law. Yeah,
beautiful law. One of the best laws.
Very good law.
Very good law.
What it said essentially was it divvied up the days of the weekend for football. And it, from the second Friday in September all the way through mid-December, essentially said that the NFL could not play games on Friday night. That was the high school football night. Obviously, Saturday became college football day, and then Sunday became NFL day. The NFL in the past 5 years has really, really, really tried to stretch the boundaries of what the NFL schedule looks like. And it's easy to do that when you play in London. You play at 9 a.m. Eastern time, and you have a whole new window on Sunday. They've started playing Saturday playoff games in December, right? Which is after the December kind of these delineations in this law laid out. And they've started playing on Fridays as well. And this game on Friday was the first Friday game the Eagles had played in like 60 years, something like that. But the way that they got around this law is that the law, again, as I said, kicks in for the second Friday of September. So first week of the season, the NFL right now, because of where Labor Day falls, first week of the season has a Friday that's before the second Friday of September. So the NFL played here. Next year, again, there is a Friday that is before the first Friday of September, second Friday of September on the NFL calendar. If I were a betting man, Will, and you know that I am, I would almost guarantee, stone cold lock, that the NFL plays on a Friday night in the first week of the season next year as well. Another Friday game that they've had recently is the Black Friday game. That's obviously in this window, but the way the Sports Broadcasting Act laid out is that the bulk of the game has to happen before 6 p.m. if the NFL is to play on Fridays. So most Fridays, the NFL is not interested in that. People are at work, people are at school. But Black Friday is one where you can play a game starting at 3 p.m. Eastern and have it be normal. So we're going to see more NFL games on Black Friday. We're going to see more first week of the NFL season games on Friday. We're going to see the NFL push this boundary as much as possible in every direction, because the NFL really is thinking about its schedule as TV slots. And if you have eight teams playing at once on Sunday, that's great. But if you can have four teams playing at the same slot on Sunday and then four other time slots where people are watching the richest, most popular league in North America, that's big business. So this law still exists. I wouldn't be shocked if the NFL tries to repeal it at some point, but the NFL is going to keep working on ways to get around all of these little quirks in the schedule, because they really are looking to dump Christmas Day, right? This is an NBA day for the past two decades. The NFL is taking that away from the NBA. If I'm Adam Silver, I would be livid about this, but
with Netflix, right?
Netflix. Right. So yeah, every little empty space on the calendar where the NFL can put a game, I think you're going to see them try to do it. And Thursdays and Sundays and Mondays are not enough anymore. They're going to keep pushing the boundaries.
I feel like somebody at Netflix was like, you know what? When are people the laziest, most commercially oriented, and totally housebound?
Bingo.
Jesus's birthday.
Nailed it.
Right? Let's go ruin Adam Silver's financial planning for the year, and let's just come on in. We'll call our friends at the NFL. This is a match made in heaven. You know,
totally.
What does the Sports Broadcasting Act of 1961 say about Tuesday night action?
Oh man, look out, action! This is what the Robin Pod fans want to know. I think
bringing it back to the Mac.
I think this is just for those
return of the Mac.
Those 3 days. But yes, if Tuesday night action became a big appointment viewing for football fans, I would not be shocked if the NFL decided, hey, we're going to take that too. Let's do Tuesday night football on ION, or Tuesday night football on Twitter, right? Whatever you want to call it. If someone's going to pay them for it and they think people will watch it, the NFL won't do it. That's for sure.
Coming up next, the Ball State Cardinals on BN Plus.
Exactly. Yeah, you just get pushing all these Mac games to streaming services you've never heard of.
This might be our worst work, and that means that it's our best work because that's worst is best, because we contravene social norms and also our entire outline to go in a certain direction and follow our hearts. And that's all you can ask of.
I learned about antediluvian, and I learned how the red turf in Eastern Washington actually came to be, the little known story.
It was that
of the firework disaster.
It was that sick bastard, Jim McElwain, right?
Classic Jim McElwain story.
We should do this again, and I think we will.
we don't
have a choice. This was great. I didn't even have to read the Club Sportico promo, because you just took that away from me like Netflix doing it to Adam Silver. So
must watch TV, by the way, on a Saturday, September 14th at 12 p.m. St. Francis Red Flashes playing host to the Central Connecticut Blue Devils. Must watch football for anyone who loves FCS football like I do.
Yeah. CCBD. Again, though, the red flash.
Single flash. That's all you need.
I believe you said just one flash, right? It's like Men in Black, right?
Yeah, you just need just single one. Yeah.
Right. It's more than I have. It's a
well-timed flash.
I can't joke. Yeah. Oh, my God. All right. Please, everybody, join in the Week 3 tournament. If you don't, you'll be missing out on a lot of fun. He's Evan. I'm the commissioner. We'll talk to you next week.